whatever exists in space is like to that which exists below. And everything that exists below is like to that which exists above. The macrocosm and the microcosm are tied together by indissoluble sympathies that can never be broken. This temporal tablet has become probably the great textbook, or the great text statement around which the Hermetic arts were built. But it is also a very splendid statement of what we all need in the form of knowledge. One point that is, of course, always a difficulty because of materialistic attitudes is that we assume that each art and science must find its own answer. We assume that each individual must work from complete ignorance up, must find his own answer to everything, and cannot under any condition unite his efforts in any common pattern with the rest of the different fields of knowledge. The Hermetists would say that all fields of knowledge are seeking the same answer, and that one answer, when it is the final and complete answer, answers every question that human consciousness or divine need can create. There is one answer that is so universal, so infinite, so complete, that it ends forever all uncertainties in every field of learning. This was the work that the alchemist was concerned with, was to discover this answer. And in order to find it, he had to explore a way to transmute or transform the substances in himself. In one of the hermetic bottles or retorts or vessels is a miniature solar system, which indicates very definitely that the whole solar system and every energy that is required is within the planet's body and within the human body. Man is the solar system. Everything that occurs outside of man is reflected into him. And every question that arises from outside circumstances can be answered from the inside research of the parallel circumstances and factors. Thus, wherever we look for questions, we look out. When we look for answers, we look in. For all answers available to man are released through the eternal divine principle, which is the seed of all individual things in existence. As much as gnat in the sunbeam or the vastest galaxy in space, each one is part of a single great pattern. And every development of life or every development of culture in the universe or in space is guided by the same infinite laws. And the purpose of the Hermetic philosophers was to trace these laws as adequately and as well as they could with the facilities that nature had given them. They realized, of course, to begin with, that you do not start out in a mad dash for perfection. You do not believe that instantly you will be able to answer all the questions. This you cannot do. You cannot take an answer from anyone else and make that answer your own until you build it into your own life as an experience of consciousness. While it is an intellectual acceptance, it has no vital purpose. But it can be possible for the individual, as Hermes points out in his great tablet, to observe the outside and use this observation to stimulate the inside. This is probably the reason why we have human beings, each one completely isolated. The Hermetists perhaps were the first to realize that no two human beings have ever been able to exchange places. That no one has ever been able to experience identically the inner life of any other creature. Man is therefore completely isolated. He cannot intuit completely. He may have sympathy. He may have a great measure of understanding. And he may share experiences which he has previously found and used to enrich his own consciousness. But he cannot be anyone but himself. And everything that he has, every experience of his life, every element of his growth, has contributed to making him a separate being. Therefore, separateness is, in a sense, the great problem. It is separateness that is giving us our problem in the Near East today. It is separateness that is stirring up trouble in Africa. It is separateness that is filling our courts with crime. Separateness is isolation. And isolation can become one of the most terrible forces in the world. Yet isolation is the only way in which nature is able to demand and attain its own end, namely that each living thing shall become strong enough to control and regulate its own destiny. Unless this separateness was as it is, there could be no way of forcing the individual to outgrow separateness, to rise above it by a long series of patient experiences. These experiences being a problem of ascent, of going upward gradually into a higher and fuller state of insight. If, therefore, we really want to know the answer to anything, the answer begins through the cultivation and the beginning of the transformation of our own natures. This transformation has been variously represented in the alchemical experiments by all kinds of symbols. All kinds of creatures, beings, colors, and sounds have been drawn in to make possible this immense and complicated series of alchemical symbols. They are all, however, simply names for processes that take place within ourselves. One of these symbols, for instance, is the raging wolf. This wolf comes in time and time again as a factor in the development and transformation of base metals. Now, this ravenous wolf can be in man a whole series of impediments that are not a wolf at all, but are like it. The characteristic of the wolf, the power of the animal, the hunger of the animal, the difficulty of subduing it, the fact that it ravages the land, reminds us of things about ourselves. There are a great many people who are rather wolfish in their demands. The wolf, therefore, is in a sense man's appetite ambitions. He is the wolf represents a phase of physical error by means of which the individual is defeating himself. Therefore, the wolf has to be transformed. It has to be transmuted. It has to become a new creature, and it has to change its colors, as in the processes of alchemical transmutation, in which finally the various elements change colors until they develop what is called in chemistry the peacock's tail, a mass of iridescent lights. These iridescent lights being descriptive of the unfoldment of the multicolor, multiform nature of the soul itself. Actually, the thing that the alchemist is searching is the soul, to release it from bondage to everything else that exists, that it shall be completely and entirely liberated, that it shall be free to be itself, that it shall then be able to bestow itself, for within it lies all that is necessary to the common good. It is in the soul that essential wisdom exists. And the soul can give the wisdom to the rest of the personality. It is within the soul that true love is experienced. It is within the soul that integrity comes into clear and defined proportions and dimensions. Everything that is important is bestowed by the soul. And everything that is lacking in human relationships is lacking because of the lack of soul maturity. So we have this mysterious thing called a chain. Of course, It's again, I think, the Alexandrians, in all probabilities, reaching back for ancient symbols, developed this concept of the chain in a way very different from what might have been Homer's original intention. But in alchemy, let's see what we have, another point here. Alchemy certainly existed in China. It existed there at least from 500 to 1,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. It existed in several other nations. It probably existed in India, and existed in many places, but in those areas, alchemy seemingly was for the most part a physical chemical study. The primary purpose was the transmutation of metals physically in order that wealth might be accumulated. Now, wealth is the false value. It is the false gold, the fool's gold, which the chemists searched for in vain, and even if they found it, most of them died from possessing it. This physical gold was the goal of the early chemical experiments in most ancient countries. And today, another type of gold, and that is some form of utility, is lying behind nearly all the advancements of our arts and sciences. We are not looking into the sciences and arts that we may become better human beings, but rather that we may have more conveniences. We may still higher increase our standard of living and can gradually escape from the inevitable proper consequences of our own misdeeds. Therefore, alchemy and chemistry in those days was not a philosophical and religious art, but an art based upon the concept of profit. And of course, material profit paralyzes any art and destroys completely the possibility of its fruition. Any art or science which is commercialized is set back 1,000 years at least. It cannot escape into its own integrities. Therefore, prior to the Alexandrian period, it seems that the transforming of base metals was regarded as a literal thing. And it was in Alexandria that this entire concept was made metaphysical, and the alchemist became an alchemistical philosopher, one in whose nature the transformations were of a higher and more exalted nature. Having faced the problem of the literal chemist, we then can go to the consideration of the literal almost everything that we know today. We know all the various chemists, the great industrial institutions that maintain chemists, the cosmetic institutions. We know the pharmaceutical houses that have chemists working day and night to make new pills or serums or something of that nature. We are aware that chemistry is tied to all of these problems. We also realize how physiology and physics and anatomy and biology are tied to laboratory experimentation and to all kinds of repeated experiments that have been done 1,000 times and actually have very little to do with the final shape of anything. There were rules that were to be set up but never were effectively enforced, for example, in vivisection, where it was assumed that it would be perfectly possible for one animal to be sacrificed, the entire record be preserved in film with all its details and circulated among all the institutions that needed the information. The fact that each one of them had to torture some poor creature by the dozen to have exactly the same results and not to gain one new bit of knowledge would have been a perfect example of what the Alexandrian hermetists considered to be debased and false knowledge. But we have it. We have it because the higher aspects of the matter were never really considered. Now, in India, we have mystical sects, and we have them also in China and Japan, that had to do with yoga. And the more we study the Hermetic tradition, the more certain it becomes that these people possess some kind of yoga. They possessed a chemistry, an alchemy of disciplines within themselves. It would not be difficult to explain this because we know that East Indian, Chinese, and many other nations traded in Alexandria. There's no doubt that scholarship went along the caravan routes and reached Egypt even earlier. There's no doubt in the world that the philosophies of Alexandria were influenced by Buddhism and yoga. This is now admitted even by the most skeptical thinkers. If we take Platonism or Neoplatonism, or if we take the Hermetic science and impose a yogic structure upon it, I think we have exactly what the ancient symbols of alchemy tell us, namely that the entire system was founded upon a process of unfolding the potentials in the individual. Yoga became a term in the East, and alchemy became its equivalent in the West. And to a large measure, this is true of Kabbalism, and it was true of the Rosicrucian mystics of the 17th century, the original ones. They all seem to have been nourished by the same general concept and belief, namely that there was a series of steps by means of which the individual ascending moved upward from the earth to the abode of the deities. Now, in man, the abode of the deities, according to alchemy, would be in man himself, because everything must be solved within this bottle. Everything that is conceivable, and if everything that is necessary for the perfection of the individual, must be derived from the individual himself. He has certain nutritional relationships with the planet. He also has a certain electrical relationship with the sun, and a magnetic one with the moon. But these provide energy, like the energy on a wire from an electric source. But all the uses of that energy must be evolved within the individual himself. He must take one pure energy that is distributed throughout all space and must apply it to his own requirements. And in so doing, he must gradually live off of this energy. He must gradually use this energy to perfect his own nature. Not long ago, I happened to see a very interesting film which showed part of the internal structure of insects. And here we have something that is so small that it is practically invisible to the human eye without a microscope. And yet the structure of that little insect is itself an incredible mystery. No scientist knows why and how that elaborate, involved interfunction came into existence. They're in details so small we cannot see them, are a thousand times more intricate than that to be found in the highest and most expensive watch. Here are eyes that no human being can fully understand. Here are structures of motion and various digestive structures in something which is no larger than the point of a pin. Everything that is necessary is there. And it is there age after age. It is perpetuated from cycle to cycle. And it is a mystery which we have not yet been able to understand. We cannot understand the larger phases of it in our own daily life. We see energy. We see constant motion. We see the evidences of a long-range evolutionary process which ties with Homer's golden chain. We see the constant presence of a tremendous pattern of processes, lawful processes, yet the source of them is it remains always elusive. There is no faculty in man's physical nature that can discover the source of himself or the source of anything else. He has to go behind the physical part of himself. He has to transcend even the endocrine system. He has to transcend his sensory perceptions, also his reflective powers. There is something still deeper. He must go on to the point where he is able, as a being, to have the direct experience of the cause of all things. Until then, his ignorance cannot be cured. He has, however, a certain participation, which the alchemists also recognized. The alchemists declared that there were several orders within their own group. There were the adepts, who were the ones who had perfected the great work. Then there were the illumines, and the illuminates were the mystics. They were the ones who understood the work. They were the ones who had been given a certain participation through inner experience, through mystical reveries, through visions, and through various types of clairvoyance. These illuminates had seen or sensed the reality. They had not performed the transmutation themselves, but they knew that it existed. And because of the nature of the psychic life within themselves, they had been given glimpses of it. And we find in the laws, even as the alchemists point out themselves, that there were glimpses that every sincere, growing person has as he goes along. Glimpses that give courage to proceed. Glimpses by means of which the end to be attained comes to be recognized, even if not actually attained. So that these illuminates, as they were called, like Bamy and several others, Claude de Saint-Martin, all the mystics were able to sense what was happening. They lifted some of the veils, but even the mystics saw as through a glass darkly. They were not able to really attain, but they became capable of a tremendous faith, because inwardly they had begun to sense. The illuminate was the one who sensed the reality, and he was on a higher level than those who had not sensed it. So the yogic system there undoubtedly corresponds with Homer's chain. It is a series of internal steps by which the individual ascends to the final union with the divine. It is represented in Hermetic philosophy by the egg and the embryo. And the steps that correspond with the chain are the 11 periods or levels of initiation which are necessary to bring things into life through the gradual change of their internal structure. Finally, the last change comes when the child or the creature is born. So we have the 9 months of the prenatal epoch and the 10th month, which is the birth. And this corresponds with the 10 links of Homer's chain. But there is also another birth, the birth of a mystery. There is the birth from the womb of the alchemical art, which is the eggshell. But within the shell, in the alchemical, the magnetic field of the individual himself, his aura, that which encloses him, that which turns all energies back upon themselves, that which forms the great wall, which if properly maintained protects him from infections and all kinds of contagions, but which if depleted allow death to come in. The magnetic field is the wall of the castle, and it is that which protects everything within it. Within this is an embryo, the embryo of the divine being, the homunculus. It is this embryo growing up within man, of which his present state is a phase or aspect, which ultimately will come to spiritual birth, when it breaks through the shell of its own isolation and mingles itself with the cosmic purpose. All these symbols go on and on and on, and there's so many of them that it's hard to limit them. But we do know that they are analogous to most of the doctrines of the great world religions, that they represent perhaps the hermetic science or art, the clear scientific process by means of which we can understand the purpose of life. In other words, we do not gain it by long periods of education. We do not gain it by the commendations of our associates. We have to grow. And growth is the release of the seed of immortality. as the chemists say, there are two kinds of growth. There are the growth of the physical seed in the ground, which becomes nutrition. And on this nutrition, we live. And we, in turn, become the nutrition of something else. I remember very definitely one day when I was talking to Luther Burbank. He said, you know, when I die, I don't want to be buried somewhere. I don't want to just go into a cemetery. I want to be buried under the apple tree in my own garden so that my life can then become a nourisher of apples. Well, this the alchemist would understand because he would know it is part of the serpent eating its own tail. It is life supporting life. It is one living thing after another surviving. It begins with the most primitive forms of existence and that which lives on it. And it goes on and on to things that live on other things all the way to the top. Because there is no nutritional process, according to alchemy, except this continual dependence of life upon life. But in this we have form only. All that we have to really concern us is that out of this interdependence, this constant use of life to sustain life, nature has set this up. And for all these different steps and chains, there is no great evil. The only evil is abuse. But actually, all of these various steps and degrees are helping to develop and cause all types of creatures to improve and increase. They go on and on and on, go step by step, until they achieve their own perfection and fruition. Nature is not doing this to be unkind. Nature is doing it because it is the only way in which separate things can remain separate and until the time when they earn their union with all the rest of life. Everything has to have its own experience. And this experience seems very mysterious and strange to us. But everything is growth, and every form of life is growing, and every form of life manifests a degree of growth, and each form of life, from the least to the highest, from the tiniest gnat in the sunbeam, from the smallest electron or ion, up to the vastest cosmos, each form of life, every step between, is a link in the golden chain. For all these processes are part of the unfoldment and the release of that divine power, which is our inevitable right. Now, when we get this power, what do we do with it? Assuming that sometime in the remote aeons of aeons, we do get it. What will then happen? Well, according to the old beliefs and according to the alchemical concepts, when that time comes, that we have fully blossomed, that we have become complete in every sense of the word, and have become a sun, a tremendous center of released eternal brilliance, when the little seed in us has grown up and become a cosmic sun, then at that moment there will burst from us our solar system, a new order of life, vaster and more remarkable than anything we have known. And we will become a center of life for another great order of evolution in space. We do not know how far this goes on. Even the most optimistic of the hermetists didn't try to find an ultimate end. But to them, if you can conceive of an ultimate end, that ultimate end is not to settle back in peace and rest forever in playing harps in space. The end, whatever it may be, is that the soul itself, the inner life in man, will explode into a great cosmic usefulness. And that which has been the child will become the parent of children. That which has grown up will pay for its growth and the love and attention that it received by becoming a parent. And a son is always an apparent in a solar system. The sun and the moon and all the parts of the solar system are parental forces that have themselves grown up in space and have passed through all of the various great processes. These great processes may be difficult to understand, and it certainly is a little difficult to understand how people 2,000 years ago, without most of the advantages that we have of instrumentations today, were able to conceive of so vast an abstract concept, and it even is impossible for the average person, even the thoughtful person, to present their concept in a complete and comprehensive manner. But that they had this idea of an eternal growth as an eternal release, all change as progress, the all things passing out of existence but not ceasing, but returning better, that all experiences, incidents, accidents of life are part of this great alchemical cycle of transformations, of regenerations, of coagulations, of condensations, all things passing through a vast cycle of moral chemical factors, so that out of it we discover that chemistry is also a vast morality, that related to it are processes which we must experience psychologically as the chemist experiences them in his laboratory. Over the whole chemical field were the great chemists of so-called symbolic time. The alchemists declared that, among others, the great master of the chemists was Elias the artist, a figure drawn from biblical symbolism. That among the great adepts were the great teachers of mankind. And many of those who were called the adepts of chemistry are never known to have made a physical chemical experiment, as far as we know. They may have done so. But they had reached that point in which the chemistry was taking place within themselves. The illuminate is working with a higher degree of chemistry. The mystic, such as Plotinus, who beheld the mystery of the universe, is working with another level of this power within himself. We are all working with some level of it. And all the great adepts of alchemy are those who have warned us, as Basil Valentine did, woe, woe unto the gold makers. It was not to be a physical experiment. The gold was perfection. The gold was purity, because the gold was the only element known to the ancients that was immortal, that never changed, that could not be tarnished, that could not be decayed. Gold was the symbol of eternal life, eternal light, and eternal truth. These are the things the chemists were looking for. And by retiring into themselves and moving step by step along a great path which was outlined for them in their old literature, they ascended by natural degrees through the mysteries of chemistry, then into a psychological chemistry which used the same terms but with a much deeper meaning, until finally they achieved and performed the great transformation or transmutation within themselves. The Rosicrucians, working on the subject politically, were searching for the universal reformation of society. The Asclepiads of Greece and the healers of Egypt, the followers of Imhotep, the god of healing, were looking for the universal medicine, that which was to be the healing of all sickness. And they followed the same path with medicine. Paracelsus von Hohenheim, one of the greatest of all pharmacologists, made a great research into physical medicine, but also into mystical. And today, our pharmacology is very heavily loaded with the recipes, formulas, and discoveries of chemists of 500 to 1,000 years ago. The Arabs, the Persians, the Greeks have all added to our knowledge of medicine. But they were all searching for the same thing, not just the remedy for this ailment or that ailment, but the sovereign remedy to the supreme illness of man. And that illness is imperfection. It is not a sin, it is not a misfortune, it is inevitable. It is inevitable that the child must grow up. It is inevitable that little things must become greater. It is inevitable that small knowledge must increase. It is not that process that is wrong. It is the individual who doesn't understand this principle, and therefore makes no effort to grow, or makes a highly mistaken effort by simply assuming that it is a trick of the mind or some secret that can be imparted for a few dollars. While these situations exist, a great deal of unnecessary delusion is also present. But each one in his own way must climb the ladder, the escalier de la sage, the mysterious ladder of links, the chain of Homa, by means of which, in the end, he comes to union with the Olympian mountain and the spirits that dwell therein. And that mountain is inside of himself also. And in the magnetic theories, the north pole of the aura is well represented, and its earthly equivalent in the great desert of Shamo in Tibetan China. All these ancient beliefs tie together into geography, physiology, anatomy, art, music, literature, everything you can think of. There is the master plan. And what everyone should be searching for, to the best of his ability, and as enthusiastically as possible, is to become aware of this master plan. We may not be able to achieve it immediately, but if we can become aware of it, we will overcome the futility we feel in ourselves. We will overcome the sense of hopelessness or despair or isolation or frustration. We will no longer blame everything that happens as a misfortune of circumstances. We will see a plan, and we know that the plan is right, that it is a divine plan, that it is the inevitable way in which the deity, as the supreme alchemist, transmutes all things into the likeness and identity of himself. Well, I guess that's all for the morning, folks.